Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I should say welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the principle of free speech, free expression, and the way we think about it here in the United States, and perhaps making some comparisons between the way we think about it and the way people in other countries think about it. When it comes to free speech, the United States stands apart from most other liberal democracies. Now, most liberal democracies do indeed honor the principle of free expression, but the First Amendment here in the United States allows us to say things that in other countries would be considered criminal acts. Of course, there are, even here in the United States, some exceptions to this basic right. So perhaps we'll talk a little bit about how it is we draw that line between speech that is merely offensive and speech that is dangerous. Our guest for the program is Frederick Schauer. He is the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, Charlottesville, and before that, for a number of years, was Professor of Law at Harvard. We'll be talking about some of the things that he's interested in that include freedom of the speech and press, and questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that we just ask people to try to keep their comments brief so we can keep our program moving and get in as many people as possible, but certainly questions and comments from listeners are very welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. And if you would be listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call, or if you're listening over the Internet across the country, you may use our toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILO, which probably doesn't make it any easier to remember, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILO. Professor Schauer, hello.
Hello. Happy to be with you.
Well, I would really appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Sure.
You know, as I was thinking about this, I was starting to think about this last night, and I was thinking about the personal rights that are set out in the Constitution. I started thinking, well, what are people most likely to talk about if you ask them what's really important? And so I pull out my copy of the Constitution, and I'm taking a look at that. And I'm sure that there are some people who would want to talk about voting rights being very important. And we know that there are some people who are very concerned about the Second Amendment. So maybe they'll talk about the rights to bear arms. But I think maybe more than anything else, it's those things that are addressed by the First Amendment that people are going to spend the most time talking about: religion, perhaps, but also free expression. I wonder if in fact that you would agree, that you would think, actually, as people think about their rights, that's probably the kind of thing they're going to think of first.
I mean, whether they think of it first, I'm not sure. It's certainly one of a small number that people are likely to think of first. Speech and religion, I think I would probably add the range of equality rights that are in the 14th Amendment, and probably the range of rights against abusive police practices or abusive criminal prosecution that are in the 4th, 5th, and 6th, but certainly free speech, free press, part of the First Amendment, along with freedom of religion, would be right up there.
Yeah. And I guess I'm thinking of this in regards to this question about why it is that here in the United States we seem to go further than other countries where they do talk about that being an important right. I know in some of your writing you've explored that question. Well, why is that? Why is it we seem to have such strong feelings about freedom of speech?
Well, I think it's certainly, I don't know whether it's strong feelings. We certainly have a more speech protective and more press protective legal and constitutional doctrine than anyone. The U.S. is an outlier or exceptional on this regard. Why that is somewhat complicated. One reason, especially if you ask people from other countries, including other liberal democracies, is that we may value a range of personal liberties to do things more than others, even at the expense of other values. So most of the interesting free speech cases come in terms of the conflict, perhaps, with between free speech and equality. And some people in other countries would say that Americans are more concerned about speech, and they would say we are more concerned about equality. So, too, with questions of order or questions of community. And part of this may relate also to the U.S. being somewhat more of a libertarian in the non-political sense of that term, culture. Personal liberty is very important, and the embodiment of it in free speech and free press may have a priority over other rights that other liberal democracies would say, well, yes, that's important, but we think other things are important as well.
Mm-hmm. Something else that you mentioned is, and this may be important as well, is that the wording of the First Amendment is pretty stark in that it says, you know, Congress shall make no law, and that it seems that is something that a lot of people have taken very seriously. In the way that this is addressed by other countries, do they lay it out quite so starkly as that?
They don't, and one of the reasons is that most of the other constitutional or human rights document protections of freedom of speech or freedom of expression are much more recent than the American First Amendment. We go back to 1791. Many of these other documents are from the 1940s or 50s or even more recently. And one consequence of that, as other countries have seen various experiences, including the experiences of the U.S., is that they have written freedom of expression protections that contain qualifications, exceptions, potential for override, and so on. We do a lot of these things as well, but at least the text of the American Constitution is somewhat more stark on its face than that for most of our counterparts in other countries.
Yeah. And of course, that's not to say that we don't have exceptions and that we don't argue about what it means.
Right. I'm not sure I'd use the word exception. There are vast amounts of speech in the literal sense of that term that are, of course, subject to regulation, and nobody even worries about it. The writing on food and drug labels, the writing and words that are parts of contracts and wills and everything else, the writings that are part of the sale of securities, stocks and bonds and so on, words are everywhere, and the regulation of words is everywhere. So it might be slightly more accurate to think of freedom of expression itself as an exception. But you're clearly right. Even within the domain that we think of as freedom of speech, there are a number of qualifications, potential for overrides, and so on. Taking the First Amendment exactly literally, every use of words is absolutely protected, is not a plausible position, and I know of no one who believes it.
Yeah. Well, certainly I think about some of the kinds of things that we have argued about over the last few decades, things like pornography and things like hate speech and things like campaign finance reform and other sorts of things that have to do with regulation of mass media. Those certainly are the kinds of things that we argue about now in the places where
right.
We say, well, to what extent do we really mean that says, yes, you can say whatever it is that's on your mind.
Right. Yeah, no, we argue about it, and we argue about how much you can say and what should be the appropriate degree of government control over communication, broadly speaking. But it's not as if every time everyone uses a word, the mere fact that it's a word makes it immune from government action. There's nothing. The Food and Drug Administration and the Federal Trade Commission are not unconstitutional.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Frederick Schauer. He's professor of law at the University of Virginia, Charlottesville. We're talking about freedom of speech in the United States. And questions, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL or 9455. Something that I thought was interesting as I started looking at this a little bit more and looking at court cases, particularly arguments involving the Supreme Court about the First Amendment. The First Amendment had been around for a long time before the first of these cases really came up. The arguing about what the First Amendment means seems to be very much a 20th century sort of thing.
Yes. Sort of serious First Amendment argument dates mostly back to about 1919 in the Supreme Court. There were a couple of Supreme Court cases in the latter part of the 19th century. There have been lower court cases here and there. But the modern experience really starts just after World War I. We've been at it for 89 years now, but that's considerably longer than most other places. And certainly there was discussion of freedom of speech, discussion of the First Amendment, even if not so much in the courts, throughout the 19th century.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think is interesting, if you look at the cases in the 20th century, is that how they break down, and that it breaks down roughly into two kind of periods. And in the first period, really what people were talking about had to do with the right of people who were political dissidents to say what it is that they had on their mind, to criticize the government or take an unpopular political position, and that in the more recent years it's turned out to be many more different sorts of things, and maybe that has to do with the growth of mass media more than anything else.
I think the growth of mass media, but it also has something to do with the growth of legal doctrine. That is, when the U.S. arrived, probably not much before the late 1960s, at the position in which virtually any statement in public of a political position or urging to political action was protected, the terrain of dispute moved elsewhere, and people who were litigating these issues started from where we were in 1969 and then moved from there to other issues. I use 1969. That's the year in which the Supreme Court, in a case called Brandenburg versus Ohio, pretty much said that any form of political or ideological advocacy, including advocacy of illegal action, was constitutionally protected unless it was the immediate incitement of an angry crowd to a riot, essentially. So since 1969, the ability to urge people to take illegal action for political reasons, the ability to advocate any political position, has been so broad that people have been using that to argue in other areas. But that's why I take that as pretty much the watershed period.
Yeah, that's what you call First Amendment opportunism?
Yes, I mean, I've written a little bit about this. The First Amendment is, as you suggested at the very beginning of our talk, the First Amendment has a lot of cachet in the U.S. and a lot of cachet in the American courts, and therefore, insofar as there are issues that could be framed as First Amendment issues or framed as something else, advocates and lawyers want to frame them as First Amendment issues. They sort of seize on the First Amendment, they latch on the First Amendment, and they try to move the debate into a First Amendment terrain because that's where the legal doctrine is most favorable.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that, is that something that one could argue is problematic or misuse of the First Amendment, or would you not?
I wouldn't call it a misuse. In a way, it's how law develops, certainly in a common law system. It takes advantage of legal and political features of the United States that you wouldn't find elsewhere. And in important respects, it has become self-perpetuating.
Yeah. I suppose if one really believes strongly in as broad as possible an interpretation of the First Amendment, you'd like to say that over time, the right to free expression has been perhaps gradually but steadily expanded. And that's really not the way that it has gone. It seems that it has gone sort of in fits and starts, or at least the times when it seems that the right has been interpreted quite broadly, and then maybe we've cut back a little bit And I wonder if that says something about the fact that, you know, the line we draw between what's okay and what's not is always going to be a moving line.
Although I think, I mean, the cutting back tends to be at the edges. The progress tends to be over time pretty consistently in the expansive direction. A lot more protection now than 50 years ago. In important respects, a lot more protection now than 30 years ago. So as with anything, there's going to be slight back and forth around the edges, but the general movement has been in favor of more protection, especially in the context of including a larger range of communication within the idea of free speech than would earlier have been the case. Perhaps the best example of this is that before the mid-1970s, nobody would have thought that commercial advertising for a product, had very much to do with free speech at all. And now there's quite a bit of legal doctrine, much of it coming from the Supreme Court, saying that even if not quite as protected as political speech, commercial advertising is very protected. And that's why now, unlike in the 1960s, the First Amendment is part of arguments about cigarette advertising and alcohol advertising and gambling advertising and so on, all of which are now constrained, or the regulation of which would be constrained by First Amendment principles.
I would expect that even people who would, defend a very broad interpretation of the First Amendment would at least be willing to say, well, okay, but there are some, I am going to draw some lines. And there are some places where I'd say up to this point, yes, but past this point, no, and that maybe different people will draw the line differently. As a society, and I realize this maybe is a, you know, worthy of a book-length treatment, but how is it, can you say something about how it is over time that we, in a collective way, have figured out where we want to draw that line?
Well, I'm not sure we have figured out in a collective way. Many of these issues remain deeply contested. The Supreme Court decides them, and that's the law. But it's hardly clear that what the Supreme Court decides in some of these areas makes a huge difference to what is a society we believe. Perhaps the best example of this is the issue of flag desecration or flag burning. The Supreme Court in 1989 and then again in 1990 held that the desecration of the flag, burning the flag, and so on is constitutionally protected. This remains for many people and for many political figures a deeply contested issue. So too with pornography and obscenity outside of the minuscule category that's legally obscene, but beyond the minuscule category that's legally obscene, pretty much anything goes as a matter of law, but I'm not sure that very many people totally accept that. Perhaps so too with some areas of libel law, some areas of racist speech, and so on. So it's an interesting question about whether people are accepting the American approach to freedom of speech or just accepting the inevitable authority of the Supreme Court.
The thing that caught our eye and got us interested in talking about this was, in fact, an article in which you were quoted that has to do with what is generally referred to as hate speech.
Right.
And that is that speech that is intended to harm, to offend, to marginalize people based on things like ethnicity and race and religion, sexual orientation, gender, whatever. And that in many places, that kind of speech, many places that are liberal democracies and say they believe in free expression, that is not protected. In the United States, it is with, and you can sharpen me up on this, but I think the major exception is that exception about incitement to violence.
And immediate incitement to violence, which is an important qualification. Yes, the U.S. Is certainly exceptional in this regard. Perhaps the best example of this is the fact that there's an international convention called the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racism. It goes back about 40-some years to the 1960s. There are a number of other versions. It requires signatory countries to have laws prohibiting the incitement to racial hatred. The U.S. has refused to sign that part of these conventions. The technical international law term is reserved, precisely because having laws prohibiting the incitement to racial hatred, which are required by international convention, would be unconstitutional in the U.S. Couple of other examples. A number of countries, either directly or indirectly, prohibit Holocaust denial. There are a number of cases, even from Canada, allowing restrictions on Holocaust denial, even less surprisingly, perhaps to Americans, certainly such laws exist in Germany, Austria, Israel, and other countries. The U.S. could not conceivably, under current constitutional doctrine, have them. And so, too, in a bunch of other areas. I'll draw one more comparison. In France, which is probably among the most aggressive of Western European countries about prosecuting various forms of race and religion-related hate speech, the right-wing politician Jean Le Pen and the political activist and former movie star Brigitte Bardot have both been fined for various statements. In Bardot's case, mostly anti-Muslim statements. In Le Pen's case, diminishing the importance of the Holocaust kinds of statements and various anti-immigrant statements. These things couldn't happen in the U.S. It's one of the reasons why a couple of years ago, when there was the controversy about the anti-Muslim cartoons in a Danish newspaper, the Europeans thought quite seriously about whether the existing laws that they had were being selectively applied in the non-prosecution of the Danish cartoons. But in the U.S., there'd be no plausible argument under existing doctrine that kind of racial insult or religious insult could be subject to legal restriction.
Just real quick before I go to calls,
sure.
Is within the United States, is there, do people say, there's serious conversation about whether in fact we should modify ourselves to be more in line with the way other countries approach the subject?
Certainly you find on the pages of legal and political and academic and some non-academic journals a fair amount of discussion about this. Some of it has been a discussion that has come up post 9/11. Some of it precedes it. But yes, at least in academic circles, there's a fair amount of debate about this. It's not clear to me that there are any significant possibilities of substantial legal change on any of the things that I've talked about.
Our guest in this first or second hour, I should say, of Focus 580, Frederick Schauer, is professor of law at University of Virginia, Charlottesville. Before that, he taught for a number of years at Harvard. He was Stanton Professor of the First Amendment at
right.
the Kennedy School at Harvard, and before that taught at Michigan. And we're talking this morning about First Amendment. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have several, and we'll start with someone in Champaign County here where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
On this issue of European versus U.S. Absolutism, I'm happy where I'm living in this regard as opposed to other things, but there's a celebrated case of Noam Chomsky writing a foreword in the publication of Borasan, who was a Holocaust ameliorator. I guess he wasn't a denier entirely, but he's totally attacked for it, and in the foreword itself, he says, the foreword was used without his permission. He just wrote an essay saying that this point of view should be allowed to be said. It should be then countered and attacked. I guess I'm just bringing that up because I think that illustrates it quite well. I don't know if you treat it at all. I was also thinking of the Pacifica versus New York City, was it? The famous seven...
Federal FCC, the Federal FCC Communications versus. Commission versus...
Yeah. My understanding after hearing a documentary of Pacifica about that case was that there was really only one complaint.
Right. On your first question, I mean, it is true that that case is a good example of someone who was subject to legal sanction in Europe, but would not be in the U.S. It's a good example of the difference. It's also probably wise to bear in mind that Europe itself is not single-minded about this issue, as the Danish cartoons issue illustrated. Some European countries, Denmark and to a somewhat lesser extent the UK, are slightly more like the US on many of these issues. Other European countries, most obviously France or Austria, where David Irving was imprisoned, are much more restrictive on a range of hate speech kinds of issues. Pacifica came up in the context of broadcasting, and for many years, and still now, the Supreme Court has taken the position that broadcasting is different. That remains highly controversial. But there are restrictions on broadcasting, whether it be the no longer existing fairness doctrine or equal time provisions or restrictions on dirty words, that the courts have been willing to permit for broadcasting but would not be permitted anywhere else. So the at least one of the words where that George Carlin used is not only a word that I'm not permitted to say on this show, but is also a word that a young gentleman named Paul Cohen was allowed by the Supreme Court to wear on the back of his jacket just outside of a courtroom in the late 1960s in expressing his disapproval of the draft. So it may be a mistake to generalize too much from the way the courts have looked at broadcasting to the general American environment.
I'm very leery of even the expression hate speech. Of course, hate speech exists, but just calling it a criminal category, I mean, it should be condemned, it should be countered, but to call it something, you know, and discuss it in these judicial reviews and journals as a category.
I mean, the actual legal categories tend not to use that word. There is the question of somewhat more precisely incitement to racial hatred. There's the more precise term racial insult. There's the more precise term Holocaust denial. In most of the countries that permit these laws, there are somewhat specific laws dealing with the different subcategories I've just mentioned. Hate speech is just an informal term that gathers up a number of them, but nothing even outside the U.S. Turns very much on the exact label.
Well, it seems to me that I guess there's some evidence that more minorities have been actually, I don't know if this really is still true, more minorities have been, had their crimes in, or their sentences enhanced and because of hate speech or that category of enhancement of penalties, than dominant.
I'm not sure of the statistics about that, and obviously the question of enhancement of penalties because of motive relates to this, although it's not identical. We enhance the penalties of murderers who murder for money rather than out of passion. And in a number of other areas, questions of intent and motivation relate to sentencing, not just in this one. So, yes, it's a related area. I'm not sure it's identical, but I mean, it is something worth keeping in mind.
If I have one last rejoinder, that's the category that I think is acceptable myself. I think enhancement. And in the past, judges have had a lot of discretion to do that. Now we have determinate sentences,
right,
which takes that away to some extent. And in a way, the enhancement, because of intent, is maybe related to the fact that determinate sentencing disallowed it. I'm not sure about any of that. But.
Right. And of course, one of the reasons we have determinate sentencing is in the past, some of this discretion was abused as well.
All right. I want to thank the caller. We have a couple of others. They're both calling from the community of Belgium, which is not that far away. So we'll go first with a caller on line number 4. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Okay, I just wanted to say, George Carlin, thank God he was alive, and he did what he did. And also, especially, Lenny Bruce. And that's about all I got to say about Freedom of Speech.
Well, all right. You know, I suppose in part, I guess, part of our interest in having a conversation like this might have been in memory of the late, great George Carlin, who was so famous for challenging this the regulation of speech, that maybe gets back to this question of why it is that broadcasting is treated differently and that you can do things in print that you cannot do, that as you say, you could wear a T-shirt with that word on there, but
right.
I can't say that, you can't say that.
I mean, historically, and this relates more to things like equal time and personal attack and the fairness doctrine, historically, the courts accepted the view, the highly controversial view, to put it mildly, that because airspace was scarce, more regulation would be permitted than would be permitted in other areas. To a lot of people who've commented on this, that's a little bit of a non sequitur. Land is scarce too, and we just give it to the highest bidder, to oversimplify. But traditionally, the argument has been an argument about scarcity, and in the context of Dirty Words and George Carlin, it's been an argument of not so much about scarcity, but about intrusiveness, that it sort of comes at you whether you want it or not. But then again, one could say the same thing about Paul Cohen's jacket. So those have been the traditional distinctions, but they're fragile at best. In terms of what the last caller just mentioned, in addition to Carlin, Lenny Bruce is an interesting example. Lenny Bruce was a hilariously funny, deeply troubled, to put it mildly, person. He fired many of his lawyers in all of this litigation. He had very serious drug problems, and so on, none of which ought to relate to his free speech rights, but it's a good example of the fact that most of the important figures in the American free speech tradition have not been very nice people. Clarence Brandenburg of Brandenburg versus Ohio was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. We had the Nazis marching in Skokie, Illinois. We've had a collection of other people that, let us say, you wouldn't want to invite to dinner, who've been at the forefront of the American free speech tradition.
Yeah, well, those are, I suppose, are in the, if you pardon the cliche, those are the people who have pushed the envelope. And without that, we probably
right.
wouldn't be, we wouldn't have anything to argue
right.
about.
Including perhaps the most historically important envelope pushers of all in American free speech doctrine, the Jehovah's Witnesses. Most might be an exaggeration. Many of the important American developments in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s involved Jehovah's Witness cases. Again, people who, for different reasons, perhaps were also pushing the envelope.
All right, let's talk with someone else here. I believe this is also Belgium, line 2.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
When the Constitution was written, the concept of free speech was you know, something they relished and went after. But at the same time, we've always had a real problem with free speech. In other words, we can stand out in the middle of a cornfield and scream forever whatever views you want, but if there's nobody there to hear them, then they really make no difference at all.
Right.
And throughout our history, well, newspapers and radios and televisions have all somewhat filtered some of the things we have screaming out at us at different times, except for the examples you were talking about. And so we've had something of an editor between free speech and the general public.
Yeah.
But now recently, with the Internet, the editor has been taken away. And that has begun to generate some very strange situations, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, the phenomenon you identify was perhaps most famously identified by the great American journalist A.J. Liebling 100 years ago when he said, freedom of the press belongs to the man who owns one. And yes, traditionally, the power of the media or other institutional communicators to be, whether it be a filter or the most dominant speaker, has been a very important feature and an area in which Europeans and others are more sensitive to these questions in designing free speech doctrine than we are. We treat the New York Times and just the same way as we treat an individual speaker. Whether the Internet will permanently change this remains an open question. Certainly the Internet enthusiasts would say that, yes, this is permanently changing things so that everybody has a soapbox. On the other hand, one of the things that the Internet cannot change is the ability of the human brain to comprehend only so much. So whether we will over time see the generation of Internet equivalents to the major broadcasters or the major newspapers or major book publishers remains to be seen. We may be just in a transitional period right now, but now I'm just guessing.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you. Just to continue for that for a moment, I think that we have always tended to go fairly broad in the way we'd interpret the right when it comes to the person standing on the street corner.
Right.
Differently, if that person is sitting in front of a television camera or radio microphone, when it comes, however, to the Internet, the question that a lot of people have continued to think about as well, when it comes to the Internet, is the Internet more like the newspaper or is it more like broadcast or is it something
else? Certainly in terms of legal regulation, that one's easy. It's more like the newspaper. The forms of legal regulation that have been allowed for broadcasting have not been allowed for the Internet, and we see in many respects the consequences or effects of that. There's lots of stuff on the Internet that you won't find in the mainstream press. One of the interesting examples of all of this, when Paul Cohen won his case in the Supreme Court in 1969, allowing him to say what he thought should happen to the selective service system and the draft, the word that he used was part of the lawyer's briefs. It was part of the oral argument in the Supreme Court. It was part of the decision of the Supreme Court. It was not part of the New York Times report of that decision.
Let's take another caller here. Someone on line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello.
Hi there. I was just hoping to see if you can give me some insight on the Bush administration's free speech zones they've set up and the legality of all that.
I mean, I don't know the exact details, but and it would probably be a mistake to think of this as just the function of the Bush administration. That is, there are a number of different areas in which protesters are thought to create undue physical danger or undue intimidation, and indeed, most of the law about this is a law about restricting the protesters at abortion clinics. So when we see around government buildings or so on, restrictions designed to keep speech in certain places and not others. The theory is that a crowd of speakers is not only speaking, but it's also a crowd. It can be intimidating, and so on. Obviously, any of these regulations are subject to abuse, but some degree of common sense suggests that there has to be some. The fact that the Hare Krishna people can be in the airports but not at the departure gates is one example of this. Abortion clinics are another. Potentially violent demonstrations near or around government buildings or at political conventions is another. At times we get it right, at times we get it wrong, but it's hard to imagine that we could not, that we could live without at least some form of what is a technical matter called restrictions on time, place, and manner. It gets more problematic, to put it mildly, when the restrictions are imposed selectively, when they're based on the point of view of the speaker. And we have to be wary to make sure that doesn't happen. But simply saying no protesters within 50 feet of the president or a woman going to seek family planning services doesn't strike me as on its face absurd.
We have about 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Just again, very quickly, our guest is Frederick Schauer. He's professor of law at the University of Virginia, Charlottesville. We're talking about the First Amendment and the idea of freedom of expression. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. A little earlier, we talked about one of the differences between the way we approach this here in the United States and other countries. It does have to do with what is called hate speech. And there is another important difference in this clearly is something we could do an entire program about, but I'm thinking about the differences in the way that we here in the United States approach defamation and
right.
the way that it is approached in other countries. But libel particularly,
right.
I guess, is where the concern is.
Right. I mean, since 1964 in the Supreme Court case of New York Times versus Sullivan, it's been close to impossible for a public official or public figure to win a libel suit against the media. They have to be able to show that what was said about them was false. They have to show that it was known to be false at the time that it was said, or at least suspected of being false at the time it was said, and they have to show that by clear and convincing evidence. That has pretty much eliminated the libel suit from public political presence in ways that, as we just saw a few days ago in the context of a libel judgment in the UK, I guess it was for $500,000 or £500,000 surrounding the false identification of a suspect, I guess, in a kidnapping. These things are a big part of political life in lots of other places. Australia and South Africa are two examples of countries in which one political figure suing another political figure for misstatements, or one political figure suing the newspaper for misstatements, is a very huge part of public political life. It's essentially non-existent in the U.S.
The thing I guess I'm particularly thinking about is the growing tendency of, because of the globalization of communications,
right.
with someone, say you say you're an American author, you've published a book here in the United States, and you've said something in that book that clearly would not be problematic here,
right.
but that somebody, if they feel that you have libeled them or they're concerned about the content, they could sue you, and they could find some other place to do it where the law definitely favors them
right.
Over you.
Right. I mean, there is worry about this on the part of publishers that have an international presence, but of course it's just one consequence of globalization, and it may be slightly ironic that as there are many people in the U.S. who are urging the U.S. to look to what other countries do on questions of gay rights, on questions of capital punishment, and others remain insistent that the U.S. should continue to go its own way on questions of freedom of expression. That doesn't mean we couldn't draw lines, but what sounds horrible from one perspective, from another perspective, is just maybe we should be part of the international community.
Well, let's get at least one more caller in here, line one, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. In Champaign here, we had a thing a while back where the university forbade students to display an image of a Christmas tree in their dorm or to put an image of a Christmas tree on their room, door, you know. And they couldn't do that. They could put up a snowman, but that was all. But yet when Diwali, the Hindu holiday, came around, blue lights were strung up all over everything. And I wonder if you can speak to the First Amendment issues of that sort of control.
I mean, just
off and listen on the,
right,
on
just, I mean, just briefly, I mean, it has to start with the fact that the university you are talking about is a state university. So in many respects, although we are talking about freedom of speech, we're also talking about what the Constitution calls the establishment of religion. So there are restrictions on the ability of the state, which includes the public schools, which includes universities, on the ability of the state to endorse religion, on the ability of the state to promote religion, and so on. Since a lot of religious expression, all religious expression, is both religious and expression, the issues you're talking about exist at this very difficult intersection between the restrictions of the Establishment Clause on what a state institution can do in terms of religion and what individuals who are in that institution can do as a matter of free speech. Obviously, if there's some degree of selectivity, that strikes me as a problem. But in general, there's really no way around the fact that it's just a serious dilemma to think about whether a form of religious speech in a state institution should be thought of as state support of religion or should be thought of as speech.
I'm trying to get one more then. Urbana, this is line two. Hello.
You've talked about some of the international implications of libel, and of course the famous case that comes up is Rachel Ehrenfeld and the court case in England and the UK, in which there was a default judgment against her. This is a work that had only 25 copies available in England. It talked about Saudi support for financing terror, and the Saudi businessman who was implicated went to a British court and got this default judgment against her. There's now a New York State law that kind of, I think, protects American authors, but I see that's happened elsewhere. There's a book called Alms for Allah by Robert Collins. Cambridge University published it, and Cambridge insisted that that book be pulled off the bookshelves. I'm not sure whether the University of Illinois has done so, but this has really created quite a problem. I'd like you to comment on what New York State has done with respect to protecting American rights in this regard, and also what federal legislation may be.
Pending. I mean, I don't know about the specifics of the New York, if there's a New York law now. I do know that there have been court cases in New York, court cases in Maryland, in which American courts have refused to enforce non-American libel judgments, saying that they would be dramatically inconsistent with the American approach to free speech and free press. That seems to be a growing trend in American courts and a growing trend. It wouldn't surprise me, as I said, I don't know the specifics, that legislation will follow that. After all, American publishers do have an interest in this issue. And as the old saw goes, never argue with the fellow who buys ink by the barrel. So I'm not sure we're going to see the enforcement of foreign libel judgments in the U.S. in any time in the foreseeable future. The interesting question is there anything that American courts or legislation can do about publishers that want to publish internationally and have offices and distribution networks in other countries? And the answer to that is almost certainly no. It may very well be that large multinational publishers can protect themselves in the U.S. Their ability to protect themselves in Singapore against Singaporean laws is not likely to be a matter that American legislation or courts can deal with, and then they're just going to have to decide whether they want to do business in Singapore or not.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Well, there we will have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Frederick Schauer. Thanks for dealing with such a wide-ranging set of questions. We certainly appreciate it.
Happy to talk to you. Take care.
Our guest, Frederick Schauer, is the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, Charlottesville in Virginia. Before that, he taught for a number of years at Harvard University, and before that was on the faculty of University of Michigan. He's written many articles that deal with constitutional law, with freedom of speech and the press, and the philosophy of law.